It is Monday, April 5th, 2021, and this is Ozarks at Large. And this is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Thank you to the listeners who continue to ensure we're here every day. We reached our goal of $120,000 contributed during last week's 5 days of on-air fundraising. From everyone here, thank you very much. Ahead on Ozarks at Large today, the legacy of one of Arkansas's more colorful characters, Marlon Hawkins. The longtime elected official created a political machine, lifelong partnerships, and a few political enemies along the way. His story is the subject of this week's selections from the archives of the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy Dixon from the Pryor Center will be with us in our second half hour. After Ozarks, on Here and Now, all of the day's news, including the latest from the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. And a new book tells the stories of young Jewish women who performed extraordinary acts of resistance against the Nazis in Poland's ghettos. That's on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston, beginning at 1 this afternoon. The CEO of the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce is asking state legislators to pass hate crimes legislation, and he's asking state employers to work harder to get their employees vaccinated against COVID-19. Randy Zook made his comments in a weekend conversation with Roby Brock with our partner Talk Business and Politics. Though a hate crimes bill has had difficulty gaining traction in Little Rock, a newly adapted bill is being introduced which creates an aggravating circumstance provision that will require a criminal defendant to serve at least 80% of his or her sentence if certain motivations led to the crime. For crimes such as murder, battery, arson, or terroristic threatening, the criteria include if the defendant purposefully selected the victim, because the victim was a member of or was associated with a recognizable and identifiable group or class who share mental, physical, biological, cultural, political, or religious beliefs or characteristics. Zook says it's important for the state to have such a law in place because to be one of the few states without a hate crimes law can hurt companies trying to recruit out-of-state talent. Zook also says Arkansas businesses need to help get more people vaccinated against coronavirus because the economy can open up fully when the threat of the virus is further diminished. The state is reporting a combined 301 new cases of COVID-19 detected during weekend testing. 4 additional deaths were counted this weekend. The Arkansas Department of Health reports nearly 20% of the state is fully vaccinated. Another 15% of Arkansans 16 and older have had a partial dose of vaccine. Tax revenue through the first 9 months of Arkansas's fiscal year is up 7.5%, and the fiscal year-to-date revenue surplus, net available revenue collected beyond what was estimated, totaled $549.9 million. The Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration reports gross revenue for fiscal year-to-date is nearly $5.5 billion. That's up 7.5% compared with the same period in 2019-2020 and up 11.3% over the budget forecast. Part of the gain includes a shift in collections when the 2020 tax due date was moved from April to July, according to the report. Flags in Arkansas and across the state are flying at half-staff by order of President Joe Biden. The order is intended as a sign of respect for victims of the attack at the U.S. Capitol Friday. Flags will fly at half-staff until sunset tomorrow. The city of Fort Smith will present a series of live concerts for free beginning next month. The 10 concerts on consecutive Thursdays beginning May 13th are possible after the city was awarded a Levitt Foundation grant. The concerts will be at Riverfront Park and are presented through a local partnership between 646 Downtown and the city. A press release indicates the 10 concerts will feature a varied mix of music, from jazz to Brazilian to soul to norteño. Fort Smith is one of 25 cities in the country to receive the grant for the concerts. There may be a few clouds in northwest Arkansas tonight. Mostly clear conditions expected in the Arkansas River Valley this evening. Lows in the upper 50s throughout the region. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs from 75 to 78. This is Ozarks at Large one more time. Thank you very much for your contributions last week during Ozarks at Large and the entire on-air fundraiser. Because of you and because of a really big Friday, we hit our goal of $120,000. Thanks again. A bill to allow for adults with cognitive or intellectual disabilities to have supported decision-making rights rather than be bound by more restrictive guardianships failed to progress in the Arkansas legislature. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the concept is gaining advocates in the Arkansas disability rights community.
HB 1005, the Supported Decision-Making Agreement Act, sponsored by State Representative Julie Mayberry, Republican Hensley, progressed last month in the Arkansas legislature for a time. Here's Mayberry advocating for her measure on the House floor March 22nd.
13 states have supportive decision-making laws on their books. 11 other states have partial decision-making laws. Supportive decision-making legislation is supported by top nationally recognized organizations such as the American Bar Association, the National Guardianship Association, the ARC of the United States, the National Council on Disabilities, National Disability Rights Network, Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, Administration for Community Living, and the American Association of Retired Persons. Why do these organizations support this? Because of liberty.
Supported decision-making is often defined as supports and services that can help an adult with a disability make his or her own decisions by relying on trusted friends, family members, professionals, and others.
This gives a person an opportunity to have trusted supporters who are legally recognized to help guide, to gather information, to weigh out the pros and cons with you, have discussion, so that you, the person with the disability, can decide. This does not eliminate guardianships. There is a place for guardianships, and in many situations, that is absolutely the right decision. But this gives one more option for families.
Despite progressing in the Arkansas legislature, the Supported Decision-Making Agreement Act failed on the House floor. Legislative critics during debate claimed people with disabilities could easily be taken advantage of under such an agreement. Written into the bill, however, are myriad safeguards. Supported decision-making agreements are signed by the adult with a disability and the supporter in the presence of two or more attesting witnesses or a notary public. Disability rights advocate Diana Verity lives in Little Rock.
I have a son, 17 years old, who has autism.
Whom she's raised with her husband, Steve.
I also work in the disability field, provide training and technical assistance around autism and other developmental disabilities to the general public and to providers of services. But, you know, for this, the reason why I'm involved in this is because important to my kid.
Important because her son Bradley will turn 18, but unlike other emancipated American boys his age, he'll require legal guardian supervision to help manage his physical assets and personal affairs. Establishing a guardianship entails a legal proceeding conducted in a court of law, many times not involving the client. Often parents serve as guardians or an adult sibling. Family friends can also be appointed guardians. Lacking that, the court appoints a professional guardian. Guardians are subject to legal supervision to prevent any abuse or malfeasance and must file annual reports to verify the needs of their ward are being met. Laws that govern guardianships vary from state to state. Verity is an advocate for supported decision-making as a more appropriate alternative for her son.
What it would do is it would create a mechanism for individuals with autism and other disabilities to enter into voluntary agreements with people who they trust. It could be their parents, it could be other family members, or it could be close family friends called supporters who would support them in making important decisions.
Adults with disabilities seeking a supported decision maker participate in choosing their supporter. They may also file abuse or mistreatment complaints about their supporter to Adult Protective Services Unit of the Arkansas Department of Human Services.
It prevents them from being kind of steamrolled, pushed to make decisions that they don't want to make.
Conversely, their supporter can be called in, say, by a disability service provider.
Having a trusted supporter and having that agreement, definitely what it does is it signals to those service providers that they need to ask that person who has a disability, you know, would you like your supporter to be here to help with this decision?
In an email for this report, Representative Mayberry says she was saddened her bill failed to pass the legislature. She blames it on misunderstanding of how supported decision-making works, but she says she'll persist and plans to develop an Arkansas pilot program deployed in other states, which later enacted supported decision-making laws. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
On March 30th, Governor Asa Hutchinson announced an end to Arkansas's mask mandate, but many cities, businesses, and organizations will continue to require face coverings to help curb the spread of COVID-19. The University of Arkansas is one of several institutions maintaining its campus mask policy. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth spoke with John Thomas, manager of university communications, about the school's decision and the school's plans to loosen some restrictions later this year.
All right, John. So at the end of the month, the governor lifted the state mask mandate. I'm wondering, how has that impacted the University of Arkansas's mask policy and maybe some of the other health and safety protocols that the school has in place?
Yeah, the governor's made it clear that the end of the statewide mask mandate does not mean that the mask wearing shouldn't continue. For instance, you know, all state employees are still required to wear masks at this time when social distancing can't be maintained. And the guidance from the Arkansas Department of Health and the CDC hasn't changed. Mask wearing and other basic safety precautions that we've had in place since August still continue to be the best ways to mitigate the spread of the virus. So, you know, the university's guidance in this area continues for the remainder of the spring semester. You know, mask wearing is required on campus, indoors, and anywhere where social distancing can be maintained. And right now we're currently working towards having all non-faculty staff that haven't already been back on campus returning to work on campus this summer, with students and faculty returning to a more traditional fall semester. But we still have to continue doing everything we can to keep our community safe. So that's kind of the main reason for keeping our guidelines that we have currently.
Right. And as you look forward to the summer and fall semesters, you know, what are the metrics that the university is evaluating to make a plan for those semesters to bring more people back to a more normal semester?
Our campus, and especially the Pat Walker Health Center that we have on campus, is working to encourage members of our campus community to schedule vaccine appointments. Those are going on right now, and now we're starting to vaccinate students. And increasing numbers of those who are vaccinated will only help in allowing us to have a more traditional fall semester. But as we've seen with COVID-19 over the past year, we have to be prepared to change plans in an instant if we have to, and we've proven that we can do that if needed. You know, we're working towards slowly reintroducing that type of normal campus atmosphere this summer, and then getting students back to campus this fall, fully in a more traditional sense with full face-to-face classes. But the guidelines for those next two semesters, we're still looking at right now. We haven't finalized yet, but we hope to finalize that in the coming weeks.
Right. And I know people are eager to, you know, get back to normal, as normal as possible. Has there been any pushback from students or staff about the policies or from the community? And if there has, you know, has the university provided resources for staff and faculty to mitigate that?
I think we saw a little bit of a pushback early on in the fall semester of last year, just because it was also very new with everything we had going on. I think people were still getting used to the fact that we were needing to wear masks everywhere, especially on our campus. But that's one thing that we try to remind people, that our campus is a community in itself. and we have to do what we can to keep our community safe. So we did everything we could to provide masks if someone didn't have any, if they got to campus or got to class and didn't have a mask. And we tried to give them, you know, safety kits, some health safety kits that included masks and hand sanitizer and thermometers. And we tried to provide that for all of our faculty and for all of our students.
I was wondering if you knew about the university's vaccine distribution. You know, how's it faring? Do you know maybe the numbers for how many staff or faculty have been vaccinated and what the timeline is for allowing students to get those vaccines as well?
Well, I think we have right around 6,500 total that have been vaccinated, and that includes faculty, staff, and students that have been able to receive the vaccine. And that's through on campus, through the Pat Walker Health Center, who has been able to distribute the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is the one dose vaccine. And, you know, so I think that's kind of where the number is right now, but it still is continuing to grow just because some of our faculty and staff have probably gone to either other pharmacies in the region or other areas that have been doing vaccination clinics. So that's the number that we have at our disposal right now that has been done on campus, but we know it's probably larger than that.
And then looking forward to getting more staff and faculty, students on campus this semester, or returning those who maybe haven't been on campus, what is there a number that you need to hit, or what's the timeline and the plan for that?
There's not a specific number in terms of vaccinations that we want to hit. We want to get to as many people as possible, you know, before the fall semester. The chancellor's actually been communicating to a lot of different areas on campus about starting to plan on returning to campus this summer if you've been working from home. And the goal is to have 100% of non-faculty staff back who would normally be on campus by June 14th or sooner. But the Pat Walker Health Center will continue to provide that vaccine to the campus community as long as supplies are there, as long as the campus continues to, you know, continues to stay on course with its vaccination opportunities. And increase those opportunities. And if our case numbers continue to decrease on campus, we feel better and better about the face-to-face fall semester we're planning for. Of course, we're always monitoring the situation, and the health and safety of our campus is always our number one priority. So that will continue to shape any and all decision-making that we have, but that's the plan right now.
And then I was just wondering, to be back on campus, if you had been working from home, are you required to have a vaccine?
There's no requirement to have a vaccine. We have been working with our HR department to come up with a new policy for the work from home. If you feel the need that you need to work from home for any type of health reasons or for anything else that requires you that you may not be able to be on campus. But having the vaccine is not a requirement to be on campus. We're trying to provide every opportunity for our faculty that want to get vaccinated and to give them an opportunity to get vaccinated before they have to be back on campus. And as of right now, the HR department is still, like I said, working on that policy as to what would qualify working from home if you need to going forward once we get to that point in the summer.
That was John Thomas, Manager of University Communications at the University of Arkansas, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth. Just ahead on Ozarks at Large for this Monday, a conversation with Randy Dixon, who will be bringing archives from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History about the life and career of Marlon Hawkins, a man who built a political machine in the middle of the state. That's ahead. Arkansas PBS is adding a Northwest Arkansas resident familiar with the arts to its foundation board. Ed McClure, a partner at Matthews, Campbell, Rhodes, McClure, and Thompson in Rogers, was named to the foundation's board earlier this spring. He's also artistic director at Arkansas Public Theater in Rogers and has also been active in Ballet Arkansas, Arts Live Theater, and Ozark Stage Works. A new mural at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum is now ready for viewing. The work by Oklahoma-based artist Caitlin Nick is based on the Rams' motto, "Where the spirit of art unites us." The new work is the real-life representation of Nick's winning submission in the Rams' Call for Works outdoor mural contest. The mural is outdoors, and the museum is still suggesting inside the use of masks and leaving room for social distancing while in the museum as well. The Bentonville Library is celebrating American art throughout the month. Up next, a joint conversation between library and Crystal Bridges folks about books at the library concentrating on American art. The conversation is at 2 tomorrow. It's free, and we'll have a question and answer session. And while free, registration is required through a link at bentonvillelibrary.org.
Support for KUAF comes from Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods, makers of wholesome foods since 1978, including a variety of whole grain, organic, gluten-free, and non-GMO snacks, baking mixes, and flours. More at bobsredmill.com. KUAF is supported by the Farmer's Table Cafe, where locals meet and eat, located at 1079 South School Avenue in Fayetteville. Farmer's Table is currently offering curbside takeout, heated outdoor dining, and limited indoor dining with air filtration. Open Tuesday through Sunday, 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. TheFarmersTableCafe.com for menus and more.
I love the people of Conway County, and their welfare and safety has always been my primary concern. I have tried every way that I know how to protect the life and the people of Conway County.
This is Ozarks at Large. That is a quintessential Arkansas voice that you may not recognize, but Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, is here to tell us more about that voice and the man it's connected to. First of all, Randy, welcome back to Ozarks at Large.
Thank you, Kyle. It's great to be here.
Who'd we just hear?
That was Marlon Hawkins. And you may or may not know his name, but if you were around in Arkansas in the 60s and 70s, you would know who he was. He was only a sheriff in Conway County, but his political reach went statewide. And he even made, you know, national news because of his persona. He was a bigger-than-life politician and public servant.
He was bigger than life, and he was polarizing, both inside Conway County, with the county seat of Morrilton, where he lived and served, and in the other 74 Arkansas counties. He was, like you said, for a time, a household name among Arkansans.
Absolutely, and I talked to Ernie Dumas, you know, longtime journalist and friend of ours, about I guess just sort of the kind of politician he was.
Marlon Hawkins is one of the great characters in Arkansas history, which is kind of remarkable in that he was simply a lowly county official in one of the in a small rural county in Arkansas, and but nevertheless he was one of the in the 1960s and 1970s, he might have been one of the most recognizable names in Arkansas, one of the four or five most recognizable names in Arkansas, because he became such a famous person in Arkansas, not just in Arkansas, but nationally. There were a lot of articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post about Marlon Hawkins in those days and far on into the 1990s.
This is a story about old school Arkansas. And it's a story that is about old school elections. And you and I are of an age that when we were young, election nights were different than they are now.
Well, Marlon Hawkins really knew how to work on election day or leading up to election day. And I was lucky enough to have a conversation with his son, Bruce, who was former state representative and is now a lobbyist, probably one of the most powerful in the state. And he told me about what it was like on election day at his house.
His knowledge of politics was outright amazing. It truly was. And I would have to say that influenced my decision to run for office in 1983, I believe it was. But he was just a true, true politician with a great, great big heart. Sometimes controversial, most of the times not. You know, and he, election day at our house in Morrilton, our little bitty house, was crazy. He would have the old rotary phone dial, phones that, and we had probably 25 those jacks that you put on the, in the on the baseboard of your house. He'd have a woman on every line, and they're hammering votes. They're calling friends. They're calling family to make sure they voted, to get out their vote. Prior to that, days leading up to the election, I would wake in many, many mornings and walk into the only bathroom we had in our little house, and there would be 8 to 10 what Marlon called haulers. These are the people that knew everybody in the whole district. They divided up the precincts and divided up the people, and they didn't have computers. It was, everything was done by hard copy, and there was paper flying everywhere. But and I've seen my mother flipping eggs in a cast iron skillet till she couldn't stand up. She fed them the coffee pot after coffee pot. That was what they did to prepare for elections. You know, I've told
so is that what they considered the, I guess they would say, a machine?
That's the machine. Marlon Hawkins invented it. He invented the game of machine politics.
I tell you, that is a cinematic retelling of what an old rural or ruralish political machine was like. I that description.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And you know, you hear, you know, machine, political machine sound like a bad thing, but that was a working machine, and it was used, you know, Clinton did it. Especially in the Delta, you know, when he mm-hmm. would get votes out, and it's working. It's you know, working the people and working the voters.
When you and I first discussed that this was going to be the subject, I told you that I thought this would be the most complicated subject we've discussed. Yes, and yes, I understand we've talked about race and gender and other things, but complicated because Marlon Hawkins, as I mentioned earlier, was polarizing. And a complicated man, and it was, there were complication situations around him and politics.
Oh, well, he had his fans, you know, his followers who were staunch, and then he had his enemies, and who were just as strong. And I think one of the biggest was a journalist who had a paper in Morrilton. His name was Gene Wirgis, and he would constantly write editorials and stories about what he found as corrupt with the sheriff. And this is a news conference that I found in the archives where he doesn't really pull any punches, where Marlon Hawkins kind of lets loose on Gene Wirgis.
This is the same Gene Wirgis who wrote such editorial during the Marlton city manager campaign as, yes, the city council has a record, so does Al Capone. The same Gene Wirgis who said the county judge would put his arms around you and pick your pocket at the same time. This is the same Wirgis that said the county judge was not a fit subject to go to church. You know that if he had not printed these quotes, that the county judge would not have received the $200,000 judgment against he and the Marlton Democrats. This is the same Wirgis that the county clerk obtained the $75,000 judgment. Our county was founded and has prospered under the Constitution, which provides for freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and freedom of speech. But we feel that these freedoms can be abused. To us, this was certainly the case of the former editor of the Marlton Democrat and also some of the state's larger newspapers, who have joined him in writing editorials and news items that are half facts and slanted to fit their thinking. Do you call this freedom of the press? It will be a sad day for our country if we individuals continue to stand by and permit the so-called crusading editors to crucify people's character and reputation just because they have the weapons to do so. I am a firm believer in the fact that you can single out any individual, regardless of how good his character or his reputation is, and keep printing false statements and making false statements about this individual's character and reputation, that you yourself will begin to believe that that story is true. At the same time, you have crucified, you have hurt the character and reputation of your fellow citizens.
You know, this was a small rural county, and then you had this fight and this controversy that made statewide news, and from times, you know, it made national news. It was in the New York Times, and there were articles in some of the bigger publications. But I did talk to Ernie Dumas to kind of put it as a journalist in perspective with Gene Wirges.
So Gene Wirges was kind of a muckraker, and so he began to write stories about corruption, and so it got to be a war, and he sided with Winthrop Rockefeller, and Rockefeller supported Gene Wirges, and so that became a big battle with Gene Wirges, and they would arrest. They eventually ran him out of business. They'd arrest him and charge him with a bunch of stuff, and he'd have to spend a little time in jail. And so they eventually destroyed him, his business.
To me, Marlon Hawkins seems to be a Shakespearean character, because even today, if you go to Conway County, you will hear people tell about the things that he did, right, for people, his supporters mm-hmm. especially, but people who might be out of a job or have lost a home, and the things he would go over and above. But if you were not a Marlon Hawkins associate, or if you were, you know, a critic, he could make life very rough for you in Conway County.
Oh, you were either furrying or a guinea.
Yeah.
And yeah, he did do things for people. I've heard stories that he would go to the grocery store and buy a bag of groceries for a family that maybe their house had burned or they were out of a job, and he would, you know, personally deliver these things to their houses. But he made enemies, and one of them was in his own home county.
Oh, right.
By the name of Winthrop Rockefeller. And as he got more, they were friends at first, but as Rockefeller got more into politics, I think they sort of had a falling out, especially because Rockefeller was a Republican. But Hawkins' son, Bruce, talks about, the fact that he could not support a Republican.
My father was a yellow dog Democrat. And I guess had it not been for that, then they'd probably been great friends. My father was not going to vote for a Republican and not encourage any of his friends to vote for a Republican. That's just the way it was. Today's world is not like that. Today's world where, as you know, most are independent. They're not Democrats and they're not Republican. But it wasn't that way back then. And when he did not support Governor Rockefeller when he ran for office, in fact, I think he ran twice for office, and never carried Conway County. He did not even carry his home county. that was that machine we're talking about. And, you know, there became a little bitterness.
It's Bruce Hawkins, son of Marlon Hawkins. Marlon Hawkins, longtime elected official, longtime sheriff of Conway County. That's where Morrilton is the county seat, and was a towering political figure in Arkansas politics for some time. And through the help of archives and interviews, we're looking back.
He was an interesting guy in that he had a unique look. He lost his eye when he was 8 years old. So he had a glass eye. And he was known to occasionally say if he was going to do something, that he would just kind of turn his blind eye to it if he needed to get some things done. So I guess that was sort of a you know, wink, wink from Marlon.
Right. We should mention that surrounding Marlon Hawkins' career and reputation, especially, I think, outside of Conway County, were, depending on who you were talking to, considerations that there might be corruption to people who outright believed it was the most, in their thoughts, the most corrupt county in Arkansas.
Absolutely. You know, he was in office for 37 years, and he made a lot of friends. Well, he wrote a book called How I Stole the Election.
And stole is in quotes.
That was his sense of humor.
Yes.
He did it as a joke because the whole premise of the book was that he stole the elections by doing good things for everyone in the county. And, you know, there was no doubt that he loved Conway County, and he lived to serve. In his mind, he really did.
But nobody serves forever. And eventually, the political, or at least the in-office political career of Marlon Hawkins comes to an end.
Yes, and he announced his retirement in 76 that he was not going to run again.
I will not be a candidate for re-election as sheriff of Conway County. Neither will I run for any other political office during this 1970 primary. You can rest assured, my friends, that this has not been an easy decision for me to make. It is one that I made with a heavy heart after asking divine guidance and counsel of some of my very closest friends. It is difficult, certainly, to leave the sheriff's office and his supporters who have stayed with me throughout thick and thin, good and bad, and who rely on me and who I have leaned on heavily. My wife, Marvine, unfortunately is not enjoying good health, and 37 years in public office has also mellowed me and made me a little wary. I think it best for my family and for myself to not seek re-election.
Ernie Dumas, you talk to him, and he kind of tries to sum up at least what Marlon Hawkins thought.
Yeah, I ask you, was he really corrupt? You know, there were people who insisted that it was an entirely corrupt system that Marlon Hawkins ran. And I think Ernie Dumas summed it up pretty well.
He went out of his way to help everybody in the county. And so that's kind of what he did over the years, even as the sheriff. I think he would, somebody's son gets in trouble, he kind of takes care of him. He's not going to send this guy off to prison and maybe he's so, and everybody in the county had some obligation that they felt toward Marlon Hawkins, and in that respect, I think he was a superior public servant in those ways. But he also expected to control things. That was part of his he would argue that that's how I was able to help people. I had to stay in control so that I could help people. And that would be, I think, Marlin's argument about whatever little crookedness he was engaged in. It was just so that he could stay in power and do good things for people. That would be Marlin's explanation for what he did.
We're going to end here in a minute with just a wonderful little juicy piece of dialogue between a reporter and Marlin Hawkins. I first want to tell before we get there.
His son even said he had heard him say this before. Because I quoted it to him, and he said, oh, I can remember him saying that. And that was sort of the way he thought of his life, his career.
Before we get there, I'll tell you that Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. You can go to their website, just put Pryor Center in a search engine, and spend all day and then many more days just searching. Put in a date, put in a name, put in a fact or a place, and between the archives that have been digitized for KATV and the interviews done, you know, that are original to the Pryor Center, fascinating history. All right, Randy. Thank you so much. This has been a blast going back into the past this time.
Oh, this was a good one, I think.
Sure.
Yes, sir.
Does this mean that you're going to bow out of politics completely?
Well, let me answer that by asking you a question. How long would a fish live if you took him out of water and threw him on the bank?
What is chaos terrain? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. Earth is not the only one that has some form of chaos, though on different planets and moons, chaos comes in the form of ridges, cracks, and jumbled masses of land. This is called chaos terrain. These terrains can be found on Mars, Mercury, Europa, and even Pluto. However, the specific causes of this weird jumbled up pieces of geology are still relatively unknown, especially since chaos terrain looks very different across the solar system. For example, Martian chaos terrain is believed to be tectonic collapse features when water came out of the surface, forming masses of blocks and jagged ridges and mesas that led into ancient river basins. There are also areas where ice may have sublimated in large volumes, also called galaxious chaos on Mars. By counting craters in these chaotic regions, it is estimated that the chaos terrain is about 2 to 3.8 billion years old. However, on Europa, impact events penetrate the surface and liquefy the crust, twisting and turning the water ice surface into chaotic terrains. Now on Pluto, chaos terrains are muddled mountains and glaciers colliding together on the western shores of the Sputnik Planitia Basin. So who knows how this chaos terrain has really formed, but hopefully a lot of geologic areas in planetary science is still yet to be explored. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is produced in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas. You can find more episodes at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. New Arkansas legislation passed unanimously by both chambers in Little Rock creates the new Alzheimer's and Dementia Advisory Council. The council will be charged with overseeing an Alzheimer's and dementia disease plan. David Cook, the public policy manager at the Arkansas chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, recently talked with us about the legislation. Cook says the state must address the growing number of people and families dealing with Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's is a public health crisis here in Arkansas. More than 60,000 Arkansans are currently living with Alzheimer's, and that number is only expected to climb in the next 4 years. And so this legislation creates a mechanism to ensure that the state is prioritizing its response and coordinating its response to Alzheimer's, but it also will prepare the state to be better positioned to submit a competitive application in the next round of federal funding. And also it will ensure that, you know, the workforce, caregiving, Medicaid, and public health issues and opportunities are identified, and agencies and partners are working together with advice from internal and external partners, just to better position the state to improve its response and increase issues like public awareness, support for our family caregivers, ensure that our healthcare workforce is prepared for the rising need, and also examine just the access and quality of care that's available to folks who are facing issues of Alzheimer's and dementia, and of course, their family caregivers.
And as you mentioned, nearly 60,000 Arkansans now estimated to be afflicted with Alzheimer's. Is it expected that that number will go up over the next 5 or 10 years?
Yes, sir. So currently, as you mentioned, with the baby boomers reaching retirement age and Arkansas being an aging state, we do anticipate a climb to over 67,000 Arkansans by 2025, which would be an increase of 15.5%.
It seems as though this council that will be established through this legislation is at least partly sort of seen as a liaison between families affected by Alzheimer's and state and care providers. Do I read that right?
Yes, sir. So this is similar to other advisory councils we've had in the state and task forces that have come together and ensures that the minds that are most impacted by the disease are coming together to develop strategies and to inform the legislator of possible moves they can make to, again, improve our response to the disease. Your listeners need to understand this isn't the first attempt that we've made. Arkansas was one of the first states to actually adopt a state Alzheimer's plan in 2011. Since then, the state has not updated the plan, so it was in bad need of an update. And so this effort will ensure that some of the brightest minds in the state are coming together. And we've also allowed for caregivers and those directly impacted by the disease a place at the table so that they can share their stories and experiences. Often state lawmakers are faced with this disconnect. They don't understand how the disease is touching their district. But as you know, Alzheimer's impacts just about everyone we know. We all have that person in our lives who have either been through the disease or have cared for someone with the disease. It's very rare that we meet someone who hasn't been touched in some way. And so this is a critical first step that the state is taking to ensure that their voices are heard and that we are again addressing the unique needs that are created by Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is not a normal part of aging. It creates an impact. It has an impact on our taxpayers, our workforce, members of law enforcement, other first responders. So it's very critical that the state develops a comprehensive strategy to ensure that we meet the unique needs created by this rising health crisis.
And I've mentioned Alzheimer's often, but I should point out it is the Alzheimer's and Dementia Advisory Council. So even if it is not medically diagnosed as Alzheimer's, but another form of dementia, it is included in this council and this approach statewide.
Yes, sir. And that's a very critical point. Alzheimer's is the leading cause of dementia, but we know that there are other dementias that are prevalent in the state, such as dementia with Lewy bodies or Parkinson's disease. And so in this attempt, we wanted to make sure that the language was inclusive of all forms of dementia because they are all contributing to the health crisis that is created currently here in Arkansas.
David Cook is a public policy manager at the Arkansas chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. There is a 24-hour hotline for help with Alzheimer's-related questions, 800-272-3900. That's 800-272-3900.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Little Guys Movers, built on family values and community involvement for over 28 years. Little Guys Movers focused on changing the image of the moving industry one move at a time. littleguys.com for more information.
The season is over for the Arkansas Razorbacks gymnastic squad. The Razorbacks narrowly missed advancing to the national finals at the Tuscaloosa Regional this weekend, finishing third. The top two finishers moved on to the national championships. Arkansas softball team, ranked 11th in the nation, continues to be undefeated in the SEC. Arkansas is now 12-0 in conference play after sweeping Auburn and Alabama this weekend. Overall, Arkansas 31-3. The Razorbacks host Missouri State at 5 tomorrow night. The number one ranked Razorback baseball team is tied for first in the SEC West after taking 2 of 3 games from Auburn at home this weekend. The Razorbacks end their current homestand with 2 games against Little Rock tomorrow night and Wednesday afternoon. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith baseball team now 12-12 after taking 2 of 3 games from Texas Permian Basin this weekend. The offense was alive for the first 2 games, 9-1 and 25-3 victories. The Lions dropped the last game 5-4. Arkansas Razorback men's tennis team enjoying one of the program's biggest wins in a while, an upset of No. 3 Tennessee in Fayetteville yesterday. It's the second win over a top 10 team this season for Arkansas. Razorbacks next play at Mississippi State Wednesday. The John Brown University volleyball team will host Southwestern AG tomorrow night in Bill George Arena in Siloam Springs as the Sooner Athletic Conference tournament begins. A win tomorrow night in the quarterfinals would send JBU to the semifinal round in Oklahoma City on Friday. JBU and Southwestern split their 2 matches during the regular season. And the JBU men's soccer team also hosting a Sooner Athletic Conference tournament match tomorrow. That game with Central Christian set for 4 tomorrow afternoon in Siloam Springs. And it's time to adapt that Razorback football schedule for 2028. The game between the Razorbacks and Utah in Fayetteville, originally scheduled for September 2028, is now going to be played in 2029. Don't worry, though. The game between the schools in Utah, set for 2026, remains as scheduled.
Whether you listen for a few minutes a day or a few hours, whether you're listening for hard news or something less serious, when you listen to NPR and KUAF, you're trusting us to be part of your day, to curate the news and information that's important to you. This is Steve Inskeep asking you to help KUAF continue to be the source that you count on. Visit supportkuaf.com to become a sustaining member for the very first time. Or if you've given before, consider increasing your gift, because now more than ever, we need your help. Thanks.
Thank you for your continued contributions to your public radio station, keeping us healthy, strong, and independent. We raised the $120,000 that was our goal last week because of you. Thanks to the supporters who issued challenges during Ozarks at Large last week, and to you for responding and helping us meet each of those goals. You can find out more about us at KUAF.com, and as Steve Inskeep just mentioned, you can support us at any time at supportkuaf.com. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Green Forest. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors this Monday included Jacqueline Froelich and Daniel Carruth. Timothy Dennis produced today's show, next door, masked and socially distanced, in the Harold and Blanchcock News Studio. Scratching the Surface, written and hosted by Dr. Caitlin Ahrens, produced inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at KUAF by Pete Hartman. Our Monday thanks to Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History for bringing us another batch of archives from the center to our show. We'll have him back again next Monday. And we will be back again with you tomorrow at noon for a brand new Tuesday edition of our show. If you miss a daily edition of Ozarks at Large, ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large, and then you can hear that program. You can also find past shows at ozarksatlarge.com. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Get rest when you can. We'll talk again soon.